Ladies and gentlemen, your conference call is about to begin. Here is your moderator, Mr. Raymond Ibrahim.
Thank you, Laurie, and thank you all for joining us once again for another Middle East conference call. Our guest today is Lieutenant Colonel Joseph C. Myers, who was recently named the Deputy Director of the Combined Joint Interagency Task Force in Afghanistan. And he joins us today from Afghanistan. A couple of words about his background. His portfolio includes senior military advisor to the interagency staffed integrated civil military action group, core planning team member for the CivMil campaign plan, and principal author of the Countering the Nexus strategy, the policy action group. He previously served as the army advisor to the commandant of the Air Command and Staff College at Maxwell AFB and was responsible for all our curriculum at the college and instructed in the ACSC Joint Forces Program. Lieutenant Colonel Myers, we're pleased that you can join us today, and we look forward to hearing what's going on in Afghanistan. Have at it.
Hey, well, thank you, Ray, and it's a pleasure to speak with members of the Middle East Forum. I actually utilize Middle East Forum as a resource. I think it's an important important think tank that's providing very good information on issues related to our global challenges. And just, I guess, in the interest of full disclosure, Ray, we should acknowledge that you and I actually know each other for quite a while now and consider ourselves professional colleagues. So.
Right. Exactly. It's a pleasure, too. So please tell us what the situation is in Afghanistan or any.
Well, yeah. Well, let me begin by saying that in the course of this discussion, I'll do my best to answer all questions as frankly as I can. This is on the record. I know in the news media right now, the General McChrystal's assessment is out there and it's generating a lot of discussion. Just as background, that assessment has obviously been presented to the Department of Defense, Secretary of Defense, President of the United States for their consideration. I'm not really going to speak to that assessment in terms of, trying to second guess what's in that assessment. Likewise, I'm really not going to speak to issues related to requests for forces or additional resources. In the course of our policy, the commander submits his assessment, submits his request for forces, his requirements. Those requirements get evaluated at the joint staff, military joint staff level, Department of Defense level. And then at some point, a decision will be made for the president's approval. So I'm really not going to speak today on that specifically. But what I would like to do is kind of give you a little bit of the history of where we've come from really in the last year since I arrived. I've been here now 13 months. 18 months ago, I was in the Air Command and Staff College on the faculty, thinking that this was going to be my retirement tour. But obviously, like many people looking at the Afghan situation, it seemed very clear to me that the mission was under great challenge and the indicators did not look well. So instead of retiring, I volunteered to deploy and come over here and bring what I think is quite lengthy and diverse military experience to help this command and help the mission. We all know that Afghanistan has been an economy of force theater. That's been acknowledged from President Obama on down through Secretary Gates to our military chain of command. And one of the aspects of fighting a war as an economy of force is that you get economy of results. And we have not, in almost 9 years now, moved this campaign to where we all agree it needs to be. A safe, secure, stable Afghanistan with a government that the people support and is able to, defend its borders and secure and safeguard its people and have a, developing economy and a better life for the Afghan people. About 2 years ago, in the Regional Command East, which is the U.S. command, there was a decision made that we needed to bring in a group of development experts to help the military commanders and their civilian counterparts better plan, organize, and integrate their resources. And a group of very talented, young, dynamic people from the Special Representative for Reconstruction and Stabilization were sent here, and they went down to the provincial level with our military and civilian teams and began a planning process to help them develop a civ-mil plan for those provinces. After they went through about two iterations of developing these provincial team plans, they realized that, one, these provincial plans weren't nested in the next higher-level military command planning process at the task force level. Task force is the brigade command level that has multiple provinces. And beyond that, it really wasn't nested in the regional command level either. So they went back, and we completed the development of a regional command integrated guidance for Regional Command East, went back down, completed these task force level integrated plans, and then nested within each of those task force plans their subordinate provincial team plans. Now, that process was completed about September of this year, about the time that I arrived, September of last year. But that process worked so well that the deputy commander for RC East and the deputy chief of mission here at the embassy decided they wanted to maintain this staffing process and maintain these integrated plans as living documents that would be periodically updated. So they decided to form what was then called the Integrated Civ-Mil Action Group, and I was named having now arrived as a military member participating in that. So the Integrated Civ-Mil Action Group helped to improve our Civ-Mil coordination, not only at the embassy, but across through U.S. Forces Alpha with our coalition command, the ISAF command. And I think the high watermark of this staff process was when we were identified to lead the core planning team for development of the U.S. government civil military campaign plan. So that process began in really about May of this year. The plans were completed through July and were only recently signed by the Ambassador Eikenberry and General McChrystal on 10 August. Now, what's important about that plan and the concept underlying it is that we recognize that that this is all about Afghan leadership and developing Afghan capacity and Afghan sustainability to bring this country forward. That we can't stay here forever and run and manage things. We recognize that we have to provide resources at three levels of this government in this country, from the national level to the provincial level down to the local community level. And one of the deficiencies of our period of being the economy of force theater was that much of our resources were devoted to national level, working through the governance, development, informational, and security lines of operation, trying to develop a national Afghan National Security Forces, national ministries, and then trying to connect that national-level government down to the local level. Meanwhile, the insurgency, like all insurgencies do, focus at the community and village level, inserting their influence, their threats, their terrorism, their intimidation at the local level. So we had our strategy was really disconnected from what the insurgency was doing. So now that we recognize that we really have to work at all three levels across this country if we are going to have a successful counterinsurgency campaign plan. Certainly our international community and international partners are key. We have to make visible progress as we execute our campaign plan, and certainly we have to have accountability and transparency within everything that we do and with the Afghan government itself. Important tenets of counterinsurgency are security of the people. So that's a key component of the Sid Mill campaign plan, and likewise you will see that echoed in General McChrystal's assessment. And we have to help ensure the security of the population. And there's a lot of requirements that fall out of that principle. The other key thing is we have to link the people to their government. They have to have a government that they believe, the people believe is legitimate, and a government that's going to, through basic service provision of services and through, good governance and accountability, demonstrate that it's worthy of the support and loyalty of the people. Otherwise, the insurgency will be able to exploit those fissures. We have to improve this economy. Certainly everyone is well aware that the drug economy in Afghanistan and opium is a major problem and a major challenge. And we have to work very hard to develop an illicit economy and provide economic opportunity so that many of these insurgents who are not ideologues, who are not necessarily ideologically motivated, but are really at the rank and file level, are mercenary. They're working for money because they're getting paid. And part of our strategy has to be developing a strong economy and begin to reconcile many of those rank and file insurgents.
Okay, so, thank you, Senator Smyers. Sorry to cut you off at this point, but I'd like to...
No, that's fine. That's
to start up the question.
That was just a kind of a quick historical background to where we're at today, and I think we can stop there and take questions.
I'd actually like to take the first question, and basically I know you're very limited as to what you can talk about due to your situation, but I was just curious as to what extent Al-Qaeda proper, is what you could say about Al-Qaeda regarding Afghanistan, if their presence has increased, decreased, and by Al-Qaeda, of course, I mean specifically different than Taliban, not just
right.
Islam fundamentalists, just Al-Qaeda per se, and any words you have on that.
Well, yes, no, that's a good question. Afghanistan is no longer a safe haven for Al-Qaeda. Certainly, Al-Qaeda supports the Taliban, and maybe to some extent, with the maturation of the Taliban insurgency, we may be seeing that the Taliban is in some cases supporting Al-Qaeda. There's a lot of money and a lot of illicit finances that move through this country, and that is one of the issues that I've been closely involved with trying to determine the scope and range, the various venues for that. There are probably Al-Qaeda affiliated people in small numbers in this country. It'd be, I think it'd be fairly impossible to state, without equivocation that there isn't any. But Al-Qaeda is obviously not here in a safe haven. We all recognize that the senior leaders of Al-Qaeda are hiding out in various locales, we believe, in Pakistan, in the Fatah, federally administrated tribal areas, and the other tribal areas of western Pakistan.
Lori, any questions?
Ladies and gentlemen, to join the question and answer session queue, press star 1 on your telephone keypad. I will announce each caller prior to bringing you into the conference. Please remember that if you have your phone on mute, take it off mute when you are selected to ask your question. So again, to join the question and answer session queue, press star 1 on your telephone keypad. And our first question comes from Mr. David Edmond. Go ahead with your question, please.
Lieutenant Colonel Myers, thank you very much for your service and being with us today. My question is, deals with state sponsorship of terror, and I've been a believer. It's not my original my theory, but to deal with terrorism effectively, you have to eliminate state sponsorship. What do you think? If Iran is the head of the snake, if Iran's funding of the Taliban and al-Qaeda were to cease because of regime change, what have you, what impact would that have on your job in Afghanistan?
Well, I think in your question there is the presumption that Iran is a major facilitator of the Taliban and al-Qaeda. Now, I've certainly seen some of the press reporting related to maybe certain members of the bin Laden family being a safe haven inside Iran. But the extent that Iran is actually a major facilitator of the Taliban and al-Qaeda as in Afghanistan is, that's a matter of some debate. I don't want to reach too far into that. I mean, I'm not going to speculate. I think it's safe to say it's a matter of debate. There are some real concerns in some areas that, we are trying to determine the validity of. But beyond that, I don't want to go much further because, that can get into some, sensitive discussions. Certainly, though, state sponsorship of terrorism is a key component of the problem. Organizations, whether it's an insurgency, Marxist or otherwise, or al-Qaeda-type insurgency, will not be able to operate as freely and effectively without state sponsorship. However, there's no doubt that the Taliban and al-Qaeda are probably receiving a level of funding and resources well beyond what they need, to conduct operations. So the problem extends beyond state sponsorship solely. These are organizations that have across the globe sectors of support and private sector support, and these are things that we are working with our international partners and foreign governments to mitigate and to and particularly in terms of terrorist financing to stop.
And our next question.
Another question?
Yes, our next question comes from the line of Mr. Bob Guzzardi. Go ahead with your question, please, Mr. Guzzardi.
Hi, I was wondering if you could follow up a little bit on the financing. You mentioned private sector support. Can you tell us a little bit where that private sector support is coming from, and what is it ideological? I was surprised when you said some of the lower levels are mercenary and not ideological. And I was wondering if you could explain how much is financial and how much is ideological and where the money really is coming from.
Well, in terms of, let's take the second part. In terms of the low-level rank-and-file insurgents, many of those are not, they're not ideological. This is a very, very poor country. Our challenges here in terms of building this country. I mean, we're not reconstructing Afghanistan. In many cases, we are constructing Afghanistan from a place where it's really never been before. And this is a hard country. The life, living conditions, quality of life, standard of living is very poor. Many of the insurgents at the low levels are simply operating out of income, for income. I mean, that's, we tend to call them economic insurgents. And I like to draw a parallel to the FARC insurgency in Colombia. That was Colombia's insurgency is something I worked for several years at Defense Intelligence Agency a decade ago. And the rank and file of the FARC were not, you know, Marxist ideologues well-versed in the nuances of Marxist dialectics. I mean, they were, in many cases, it was a source and form of employment in areas where there aren't many jobs to come by. So we see part of our strategy in terms of economic growth, development, and opportunity is providing licit, you know, safe jobs and skills so that many of these people can come out from under Taliban influence and Taliban income and become, you know, productive members of society. And so that's the focus of a lot of our reintegration effort. Now, with respect to terrorism financing, I think, you know, there's a large body of literature out there on that and the sources. You know, we do know that Islamic Sakat is a source of funding for the Taliban. Some of these charitable donations do get commingled and make their way into funding Taliban and Al Qaeda. There's drug money is a large part of the income derived, but there's also graft corruption out there as well. And so in terms of trying to put a figure and say, well, we think the Taliban or Al-Qaeda have this amount of money, that's very, very hard to do. I mean, it's very hard to do estimating how much money the FARC, for instance, derived from the drug trafficking trade in Colombia. I mean, that's very much an analytic art, not a science. So does that put this problem in context for you?
Well, what I'm hearing is that this is not a state-sponsored activity, that there are either it's indigenous because of the drugs and the opium, or it is ideological, but it's not state-sponsored. Am I hearing you correctly? In other words,
Pakistan. I would argue it is indigenous. It is ideological. It is influenced certainly by Deobandi Islam, that's highly prevalent in Pakistan as an ideological variant of Islam, certainly promulgated through many of the madrasas that are, you know, radicalizing their students, their talibs. So there is an ideological root at the core of the Taliban, and obviously at the core of Al Qaeda. The core leadership are always going to be ideologues, whether it's this theological movement that we're facing here, or whether it's a political philosophy such as Marxist socialism in the FARC. At the core leadership level, you're always going to have ideologues, but that kind of dissipates as you drill down to the rank and file level. But certainly, you know, it's money is the engine of these movements, and without money, these movements can't do much. And so money is an important focus of our efforts here, and an increasingly more important focus of our efforts here.
Our next question comes from the line of Mr. William Edgerly. Go ahead with your question, please.
In Iraq, the Sunnis and the Sons of Iraq have been very helpful, and I'm wondering if there is a parallel in Afghanistan.
One of the programs that we have brought into being, and I guess, you know, from a counterinsurgency theory, you could call it a counter mobilization or local mobilization. And we've been establishing regional community guard forces that they're not tribal based; they're intertribal based, but they are community guards that kind of perform like the neighborhood watch program, tied and integrated into the Ministry of Interior and to the local police forces, and the local police forces supervise these community guards. Certainly, Afghanistan is very much a tribal-based culture, and a lot of our efforts are oriented on influencing and winning the tribal leadership. Now, one of the challenges we face here that's more acute than what is in Iraq is that the traditional tribal leadership here over the last 30 years has really been decimated. It's been killed, murdered, changed. You've had a lot of new emergent leaders. Some of these new emergent leaders have come out of criminal classes or the drug trafficking classes. That's not in all cases, not across all the tribes, but I'm just saying that's just indicative of parts of the problems we have here, the contrast with Iraq. But, yes, I mean, our strategy has to be valley by valley, village by village, local tribe by local tribe. And again, I think that concept is well made in General McChrystal's strategic assessment. It's a key component of our strategic framework in our Civ-Mil campaign plan. You know, it's the security of the local population. They have to feel safe, secure in their village and be free of insurgent and Taliban intimidation. And so part of our approach is, you know, obviously coalition force security, moving toward Afghan National Security Forces security for the local people, and raising up their own local indigenous community guard forces and neighborhood watch programs. So that's part of our way ahead.
Thank you very much.
Our final question comes from the line of Mr. Tom Tropp. Go ahead with your question, please.
Yes, Lieutenant Colonel, if you you actually just answered in a large part the question I had, and that was if I wanted you to elaborate on how we were going to provide, or American forces or otherwise were going to provide the security for the people that you said was a key part of achieving success in Afghanistan. So just let me follow up on the answer you just gave and ask, is it largely Afghans who are going to provide security for their own people, or is it what's the relative contribution?
Well, I mean, ultimately that has to be the end state. That's what we're all working toward. And certainly there's not enough security forces to spread out all over the whole country. You know, you can't defend everywhere at once in a counterinsurgency environment. But we are choosing these critical districts, critical zones, critical regions to secure, safeguard, clear, hold, build, bring in resources, bring in the development aid, get government functioning at the local level, get it integrated vertically from the village to the district to the provincial level. You know, we're working very hard to establish a judicial sectors, court systems in this country. So it's you know, again, the classic oil spot theory, where you start in areas and you get those on their way to self-sustainment as you move to other more at-risk areas. So, you know, you have to have a there has to be a methodology, and you have to be methodical in your plan to achieve these effects. But that is why, you know, counterinsurgency operations and campaigns take a long time. I mean, these are very difficult wars to fight.
Okay, Lieutenant Colonel Joseph Myers, thank you for joining us. Unfortunately, we've reached the end of the call. Thank you for joining us from Afghanistan and giving us those insights. And thank you for everyone else for calling in. Laurie?
Well, thank you, Ray. It was my pleasure to speak to everyone today.
Thank you.